fortunately, a lot of the governors, they all, you know, became very much advocates for roadless area conservation, more so than they had in the past, because, you know, the governors were being really spotlighted here. And we were pleased that so many of the governors did come out and say they wanted their roadless areas protected. The roadless rule really only does two things. It says no commercial logging, no cutting down of the old growth forests, and for the most part, no road building, either in connection with the logging activity or for most other kinds of, you know, economic development of the roadless areas.
Good morning, I'm Tommy Helm, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego, and recorded today at the production facilities at the CBS Radio Cluster in Seattle, Washington. Tree Huggers International is a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wilderness, and special places. From the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. Some 58 million acres of national forest lands are made up of inventoried roadless areas. These are areas where no marked inroads of civilization have occurred, and the land remains in a truly wild, primitive state. The character of these lands ranges from vast expanses of what may appear to be nothingness to high-value, aesthetic, and natural resource-laden lands, often adjoining national parks or designated wilderness areas. The drinking water of some 60 million Americans begins in 2,000 watersheds located mostly in roadless areas in our nation's national forests. In 1967, the Forest Service began cataloging roadless areas for consideration as wilderness, and beginning in 1998, the Forest Service undertook its most intensive public policy discussions and comment periods since the 1960s in order to come up with a plan for managing roadless areas. In what became the most far-reaching federal land management document since the 1964 Wilderness Act, the resulting roadless study detailed a plan to conserve those 58 million acres of national forest land from almost all logging and road construction, and was presented to President Clinton in January 2001. However, just days later, the Bush administration came into office and immediately put the roadless rule on hold, saying it wanted to explore other options in the implementation of the act. In 2005, the Bush administration put forward a plan to allow state governments to designate their own roadless areas in national forests, which required governors to petition the federal government if they wanted to protect roadless areas in their own state. This plan was later struck down by a federal court in 2006. Currently, the Obama administration has been granting the Roadless Area Conservation Rule year-long extensions. And while we at Tree Huggers International appreciate the administration moving forward, the science and public response detailed in the roadless study remains intact, and we believe the roadless rule should be enacted in full as it was intended at the end of 2000, as the current trend of year-long extensions appears designed to leave this thoughtful piece of science, management, and policy in a state of permanent limbo. Joining us today to talk more about the roadless rule and roadless areas is Mike Anderson. Mike is the Senior Resource Analyst at the Wilderness Society's Pacific Northwest office in Seattle. He's been with the Wilderness Society since 1985, and his main focus is national forest management and policy, ranging from roadless conservation to watershed restoration. Mike also helps coordinate the Wilderness Society's litigation activities, so he probably knows a few good lawyer jokes. And we're very pleased to have him here with us today. Mike, welcome to Tree Huggers International. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's nice to be here.
Mike, I want to talk to you about the role you played and also the role of the Wilderness Society in the creation of the Roadless Area Conservation Rule. But let's start the conversation by talking about just the value of leaving national forest areas roadless to begin with. Where's the benefit beyond guys like you and me who may enjoy strapping on our boots and heading into the outdoors?
Yeah, well, we're really blessed in the Northwest and elsewhere in the country with a large amount of beautiful natural national forest lands, the old growth forests, the rivers that supply our fisheries and our water supplies. In general, the best thing for the health of these forests is to leave them intact, not to clear cut them, not to build roads, just let those forests play the natural role that they have played for centuries.
And that alone, simply leaving it alone, is a benefit right there.
Absolutely. With wildlife habitats, the water quality, in general, the scientists have found that the most intact, high quality ecological values are found in the wilderness areas and in the roadless areas. So to the extent that we can keep those areas undeveloped and allow those natural processes and habitat values to continue, that's generally our best strategy.
And we should probably clarify, when we're talking about roads in national forests, we're not talking about freeways. We're talking about what are often called forest roads, which are typically dirt or gravel and were probably designed at the time of construction, less for recreation and more for resource extraction. Would that be correct?
Yeah, the national forests have a vast road system in place right now. In fact, enough to circle the Earth, I think, 12 times. It's like 380,000 miles of roads. Most of them were built for logging, mostly after World War II, when the Forest Service was really on a timber production binge, and logging roads were essential for them to get into the mountains and remove the trees. So we're faced with this vast legacy of old logging roads out there, and we're trying to deal with that as well as trying to keep the remaining roadless areas without new roads.
And by virtue of just the number of miles, I mean, there's no way the Forest Service at this point can afford to even maintain all these miles of roads.
Yeah, the Forest Service can only afford to maintain maybe 20% of its road system right now. That was one of the real motivators for the Forest Service and its supporters in Congress to say, okay, Forest Service, you already have almost 400,000 miles of roads. How much is enough? When can we say that we have a sustainable road system when you're continuing to add on more roads at a time when even the existing road system is far too large to maintain and properly manage?
And what kind of dangers do unprotected roadless areas face? Or rather, what kind of dangers were these unprotected roadless areas facing, say, in the late 90s when this study was going on?
The major threats to the roadless areas back at the time when the roadless rule was adopted continued to be logging and road building for a variety of other uses, such as oil and gas development, ski area development. And the roadless rule has, for the most part, protected the roadless areas from the logging and most of the road building. Right now, I would say the main threats that we have are from mining and from off-road recreation, off-road vehicles, the motorbikes, the all-terrain vehicles that generally people use them responsibly, but there are some of those motorized recreation users who like to go out and basically make new roads, make new trails with their vehicles, and that's very environmentally harmful to the forest and to the water supplies, and that's something that we are still working with the Forest Service to try to reduce that threat from motorized recreation.
Have we seen some grievous examples of roadless areas which have really lost their wild or wilderness quality attributes because the roadless rule may have been idle? Have we seen roadless areas which might have been suitable for wilderness designation that were really compromised by unregulated or illegal off-road use?
Well, certainly the motorized recreation does pose problems in terms of, just politically opposing wilderness designations, because when a roadless area is designated by Congress as wilderness, it becomes part of the National Wilderness Preservation System. It becomes subject to the requirements of the Wilderness Act of 1964, and that includes no motorized or mechanical types of recreation. So that's more of a political issue, and the off-road vehicle enthusiasts are often some of the major opponents for wilderness designations.
And, you know, we've also seen a lot of wildfires. Certainly in the last 10 years, we've seen a rise in destructive wildfires in the West. How would the roadless rule apply to fighting fires in the wild? Because we've sort of learned over the last 100 years that fighting fires immediately in all areas of the national forests is ultimately a mistake.
Yes. Yes, we've certainly seen over the last 10, 15, 20 some years a major increase in both the intensity and the spread of wildfires in our national forests in the West Coast, inland. And we know now that to a large extent that is the result of many decades of fires being suppressed and allowing the brush to build up to the extent that when a fire does begin, it's a highly intense fire oftentimes and very difficult to put out. So the Forest Service and the conservation community recognize that there are needs for fire suppression and for reducing fuels in the roadless areas as well as in the already roaded parts of the national forests. And the roadless rule does provide for fuel reduction work around communities to protect human health and safety. One advantage of the roadless area conservation rule was that it stopped new road building. And one of the main reasons that fires get started in the first place is by people coming into the backcountry areas of the national forests with vehicles and campfires, et cetera. And that's where most of wildfires get started in many parts of the national forest. So in some ways, the roadless rule has been a help in terms of addressing these really major fire problems that we're seeing in the West.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego, and recorded today at the studios of the CBS Radio Cluster in Seattle, Washington. I'm Tommy, and we're joined in the studio today by Mike Anderson from the Wilderness Society's Pacific Northwest office in Seattle, and we're talking about the so-called roadless rule and roadless areas in our national forests. Mike has been described by his colleagues as something of a roadless guru, so we're very pleased to have him here today. And you can learn more about roadless areas and the push to permanently protect them with the roadless rule at the Wilderness Society's website at www.wilderness.org. That's wilderness.org. You're from Michigan original.
Yes.
How did the West get its hooks in you?
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in Michigan, a town called Saginaw. And when I was growing up, there were certainly not very many forests around. It was a farming community mostly, and General Motors was building cars there. But I learned that back in the 1870s that Saginaw, Michigan had been, for a while, the timber capital of the world. And, you know, I was kind of incredulous at the time, but apparently, you know, there had been these vast expanses of beautiful white pine forests, and the lumberjacks had come in the mid-19th century and basically cut them all down. And then, ironically, when I graduated from college and moved out to Oregon, I was living in a town called Roseburg, Oregon, and on their city limits sign, it said, Roseburg, timber capital of the world. 1 century later.
Wait a minute.
The loggers had moved across the country, and they were making a lot of nasty-looking clear cuts and logging roads in the national forests around Western Oregon. So I thought, well, gosh, I think maybe I can do something for Western Oregon and some of these beautiful national forest lands that we're blessed with in the Western U.S.
Talk to me about the input made by the Wilderness Society in the building of the roadless rule. And did the Wilderness Society feel they had an advocate in their corner with Mike Dombeck leading the Forest Service in the late 1990s?
Well, certainly, roadless area protection, wilderness conservation has always been at the core of the Wilderness Society's work ever since we were founded back in the 1930s by Aldo Leopold and Robert Marshall, people who were actually within the Forest Service at that time and advocating for protection of large, intact areas in the national forests. So that interest in protecting roadless areas, undeveloped areas of the National Forest has continued, you know, for the last 75 years of the Wilderness Society's existence. And I've been at the Wilderness Society for 25 of those years, and that's been certainly a major part of my job. Now, during the late 1990s, we had a great opportunity with the Clinton administration appointing a chief of the Forest Service who was not a logger. He was not a road engineer. He really broke from the tradition of Forest Service leadership because he was a fish biologist. And he knew that road building and just the having roads out in the landscape was a major threat to a lot of fish populations, the salmon, the trout. And he decided it was something he was going to make a priority, was to protect the roadless areas and to try to make the Forest Service do a better job of managing its current roads.
What kind of input did the Forest Service get from the public when the research was going on for that? And was the desire to keep roadless areas wild pretty broad? Was it kind of closely divided? Yeah. I mean, because this whole process took 3 years.
Yeah, it was really a phenomenal public interest and support for roadless area conservation. Initially, it started out with Chief Dombeck issuing kind of a low-key, like a moratorium on road building that he wanted to see while the Forest Service studied the problem. Well, that brought an avalanche of support and calls for more. You know, why have it just be for a year or two moratorium? Why not protect these areas in perpetuity? And so President Clinton got in the act and saw the broad public support for this, and he directed the Forest Service to develop a permanent regulation to protect roadless areas. So during that rulemaking process, it was a all-time record in terms of public support and involvement in the process of developing that roadless rule. 1.6 million Americans voiced their support for roadless area conservation. I think that was like 6 times more than any other federal regulation in history, and I think that record still stands today.
So what was the reaction of the conservation community at the time the roadless rule was presented in 2000? Did you feel like this was the best document possible? Were there some compromises made in there? Was there a little bit of chipping away in order to get other entities on board?
Well, the proposal that the Forest Service came up with initially was basically sound, but it did include some exemptions, such as for the Tongass National Forest up in Alaska. They didn't have all the areas that we thought should be included in some other parts of the country as well. So we tried to make our best case why places like the Tongass needed to be provided protection, the same protection as all the other national forest roadless areas elsewhere in the country. And for the most part, the final regulation did reflect that strong public support. And so we are quite pleased with how that rule came out, and we're hoping that soon here we will see that the roadless rule once again become the national rule of the land.
You know, the Tongass National Forest has sort of been a case study as to why a lot of the roadless rule is a good idea, because over the last 10 years, it's really seen some damage done, and it seems there was this out-of-sight, out-of-mind quality to the activity there, as though we in the lower 48 weren't necessarily going to notice what was going on there. I mean, has there been some significant environmental damage done to the Tongass that may have been avoided had the roadless rule been kept in place?
Yeah, well, the Tongass is a real national treasure. It's, you know, it's a very rare temperate rainforest. It has incredible salmon runs, grizzly bears, wolves, you name it. It's really got it all. And it's also got this long history of very damaging industrial logging, and generally done at a very steep expense to the federal taxpayer, because it just did not pay really to have a major timber industry going on in Southeast Alaska. It's so remote. The Tongass National Forest has over 9 million acres of inventoried roadless areas. So it was a very high priority for us to protect the remaining intact roadless areas for, you know, their rainforest values and the salmon and the important water quality values of the Tongass.
How did you and the Wilderness Society respond when the Bush administration floated the plan to have governors petition the feds to not have resource extraction going on in their national forests, or just to not have new road building going on? How did you respond to that? Because at the time, it felt like it was either simply passing the buck, or it seemed like there was it was designed to tie things up a bit. It was designed to be a bureaucratic move.
Well, that was a real time of crisis for the roadless rule, because there had been some adverse court decisions challenging the legality of the 2001 rule. The Bush administration had just been reelected, and frankly, some of the governors of states that we thought were supportive of roadless area protection were really seriously considering coming up with their own state proposals, which we thought was a very bad idea, because the balkanization of the national forests and of our wildlands, these are federal lands. These are all America's lands, and they should not be left up to individual state governors' decisions on what's best.
That brought politics more into the mix, though, didn't it?
Yes, and fortunately, a lot of the governors, even Governor Schwarzenegger in California, Governor Gregoire in Washington here, they all became very much advocates for roadless area conservation, more so than they had in the past, because the governors were being really spotlighted here, and we were pleased that so many of the governors did come out and say they wanted their roadless areas protected. At the same time, there were some states, in particular the state of Idaho, which has, like the Tongass, over 9 million acres of roadless areas. They took full advantage of the Bush administration's state petitions process, and they did propose their own rule. And before the Bush administration left office, that exception to the roadless rule was adopted by the Forest Service, and we are still living with and battling that Idaho exemption today. Similar to Idaho, Colorado does want to have a number of exceptions for their roadless areas to allow for coal mining, for ski area development, for utility development. It's watering down of the roadless area protection, whatever meets the special interests that want to do something to build roads in these roadless areas. So we're very concerned about the Colorado roadless areas, though for the time being, they are covered by the roadless rule.
Currently, there is a pending court decision which may affect how the Obama administration moves forward, because right now they're just extending it year by year.
Yeah, in Idaho, there was a court decision by Judge Brimmer a few years back who said that the roadless rule violated federal laws. He said it violated the National Environmental Policy Act, and it also violated the Wilderness Act. Now, we have challenged that court decision, and a ruling is expected very soon from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. We are hopeful that decision is going to be reversed and the current cloud of legal uncertainty will be lifted over roadless areas nationally. But right now, there is still some uncertainty because we have not heard from that Court of Appeals yet.
So if the roadless rule were implemented as intended in late 2000, is the Forest Service even in a position to manage it? Would there be management involved, or is it just a matter of just leaving it as it is?
Well, there's lots of management that can and is occurring in the roadless areas. There is hiking, mountain biking, camping that is allowed in the roadless areas. The trails are being maintained. You can use chainsaws to maintain the trails. Livestock grazing is allowed. The roadless rule really only does two things. It says no commercial logging, no clear cutting, no cutting down of the old growth forests, and for the most part, no road building, either in connection with the logging activity or for most other kinds of, economic development of the roadless areas. There are some important exceptions, especially with respect to mining. Unfortunately, there is a special law for gold mining and other forms of hard rock mining under the 1872 Mining Act. It goes back well over a century, that allows for miners to go out into the national forests, stake claims, build roads, and mine as long as they have a valuable mineral deposit out there. And that applies to the roadless areas as well as to other national forest lands, except for wilderness. You know, when an area is designated as wilderness, then there can be no hard rock mining either. But for roadless areas, the hard rock mining is allowed, and we are dealing with a number of potential mining threats in Nevada, especially, but also elsewhere, including Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest in Washington. So, yeah, we're not dealing with wilderness areas. When we look at our inventoried roadless areas, there's still quite a bit of vigilance and need to keep an eye on potentially damaging activities. Earlier this summer, I went out to a beautiful roadless area on the Olympic National Forest in the Olympic Mountains, up the Dungeness River, beautiful trail that goes through the old growth forests and up deep into the Olympic Mountains. And part of that's now a designated wilderness, the Buckhorn Wilderness Area. Part of it's the part of the Olympic National Park, but down at the trailhead in the first couple of miles, it's an inventoried roadless area, and it's protected from logging and road building, and it's good to know that that area is got a good level of protection because it is some magnificent forest lands. Oh, I love in Oregon the wild Chelmeopsis roadless areas of, down in the Siskiyou National Forest near the California border. Incredible diversity of plants and very rugged. It was a very threatened area back during the Bush administration because there was a big fire.
Biscuit fire.
And the biscuit fire, and the Forest Service under the Bush administration was trying to log tens of thousands of acres, salvage logging, and a lot of that was in roadless areas. And fortunately, we got that cut down to just, I think there were about 500 acres that ended up getting logged amongst those roadless areas out of an initial proposal of over 10,000 acres. But magnificent areas in Oregon. I've been to many of them and look forward to going back in the future with my grandchildren someday.
Mike Anderson, the Senior Resource Analyst with the Wilderness Society's Pacific Northwest office in Seattle. Very nice having you joining us today. Thank you for making the time to be on Tree Huggers International.
It's been great. Thanks very much, Tommy.
Greg MacArthur, thank you very much for engineering here in Seattle. Much appreciated. And thank you again, Mike. And stay in touch, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International. Thanks once again to the Senior Resource Analyst with the Wilderness Society's Pacific Northwest office in Seattle, Washington, Mike Anderson, for making some time to join us today for this discussion about the roadless area conservation rule and roadless areas. You can learn more about roadless areas and the push to permanently protect them, as well as the roadless rule's current consideration before the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, at the Wilderness Society's website at www.wilderness.org. That's wilderness.org. We've also got plenty of links about roadless areas and the history of the roadless rule at the Tree Huggers International website at www.treehuggersintl.com. Also, many thanks to Greg MacArthur and the CBS Radio Cluster in Seattle, Washington for their help and kindness in allowing us to use their facilities to record this show. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media. And as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, you can go ahead and email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. Or you can also contact me through the Tree Huggers International website. And for more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, you can go to the Tree Huggers International page at treehuggersintl.com. That's www.treehuggersintl.com. You can also access Tree Huggers International via the FM 94.9 website at www.fm949sd.com. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International. We'll be back same time next Sunday morning with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wilderness, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and be well.